Michael Tippett's Sonata for Four Horns, played there by the Barry Tuckwell Horn Quartet, and before it, Tippett's Fanfare for Brass, played by the Philip Jones Brass Ensemble. This is BBC Radio 3. It's coming up to 12 minutes past 10. And it's time now to join Anne McElvoy for tonight's Proms Plus literary event, recorded earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music.
Margaret Atwood's award-winning 1985 novel, The Handmaid's Tale, was a milestone in feminist writing and a warning to her fellow feminists who may have had grounds for thinking that their key battles had been won or at least were listing in their direction. Equal access to education, the vote, contraception and abortion had been the demands of the 1960s sisterhood, but our subject today counselled scepticism about such progress. As the religious right gained political traction in the US with Jerry Falwell's moral majority boosting the standing of a successful Republican leader in Ronald Reagan, Atwood suggested there might be rather more for feminists and liberals in general to worry about. The result was a powerful imagining of a dystopia which melded the worst traits of historical dictatorships in its callous regard for the individual with a gruesome projection of a tainted theocracy gone mad. The Handmaid's Tale won her an Arthur C. Clarke Award and many followers beyond her core as a feminist writer. It's a novel that feels a bit like science fiction, but Atwood prefers the term speculative fiction. She also maintains that every form of oppression in the novel has existed in some time and in some place. My guests tonight are the writer Aminata Fauna and the broadcaster Kate Adey. Aminata, if I could start with you, there's nothing as shocking as the reality that is reflected in this book.
It's a book in which you recognise a great deal of what is going on in the world as it is now and in the world as it has been in the past. In Gilead, this theocratic dictatorship, systems of power are put in place which mimic patriarchy. I suppose they're based on patriarchy, but actually they are systems that we all know quite well that have been subsumed in that particular regard, and to promote a small group of people into a privileged position. So actually, when you unpick what Gilead actually is, you do find these reflections of the world that we know or have sometimes stepped into.
And just before we come to the reading, she has to set up how we get from a point where her country, in this case it's nominally the United States, has been taken over by this system. Just roughly how is that set up?
Well, it actually starts with something very tiny, and I think that's the reading we're going to hear about here. But the way it's set up, and this is where Atwood was extraordinarily prescient, is that she actually says that the powers that be used the idea of Islamic fundamentalist threat in order to justify what start off with very tiny repressions. And they also use the Bible, they use certain selective texts from principally the Old Testament to justify their actions and actually corral people in something that is meant to be, first of all, for their own good, but of course which turns out very differently.
So, Melanie Gray, please give us the first reading from The Handmaid's Tale.
It was after the catastrophe, when they shot the president and machine-gunned the Congress and the army declared a state of emergency. They blamed it on Islamic fanatics at the time. Keep calm, they said on television. Everything is under control. I was stunned. Everyone was, I know that. It was hard to believe. The entire government gone like that. How did they get in? How did it happen? That was when they'd suspended the Constitution. They said it would be temporary. There wasn't even any rioting in the streets. People stayed home at night watching television, looking for some direction. There wasn't even an enemy you could put your finger on. Look out, said Moira to me over the phone. Here it comes. Hear what comes, I said. You wait, she said. They've been building up to this. It's you and me up against the wall, baby. Tried getting anything on your CompuCard today? They've frozen them, she said. Any account with an F on it instead of an M? All they need to do is push a few buttons, we're cut off. But I've got over $2,000 in the bank, I said, as if my own account was the only one that mattered. Women can't hold property anymore, she said. It's a new law. Turned on the TV today. No, I said. It's on there, she said. Luke can use your CompuCount for you, she said. They'll transfer your number to him, or that's what they say. Husband or male next of kin.
It's very much...
Yes, I wanted to ask you, Kate, I mean, you've seen a lot of beginnings of dictatorships and things going on. Not exactly like the example we heard there, but does it remind you of things in real life?
Absolutely. And Margaret Atwood has about only that single description in the whole book of what has happened. There are other little hints here and there. That is an entire revolution, a huge upturning of lives, particularly women's lives, because what is in the end of that description is that they've lost their bank accounts. They can't sign things anymore. By the time this revolution has pushed through, women have been deprived of any kind of status other than that of being mothers. The threat within the novel is said to be a lack of children because of pollution, because of all kinds of contraception, because of things going wrong in modern society. So women need to give birth. And by the time we're into the novel, you realize that this is a world which entirely centers around women having to act as vessels, nothing more. They are not going to be mothers of their own children. They're having children from other people. And I think more than anything, I reread it and realized that this is a quarter of a century ago. And it was written, I think, in the sense, as you mentioned, of how far women have come, what they've got rid of in the restrictions. And we go into this world and find there are even more restrictions, and they've slid in. They've absolutely, completely destroyed women's independence, and women have no power. Because at the end, I think it's a novel about power.
Let's come back to that and also perhaps to what happens later in the novel. But Aminata, there are moments of prescience which you've already alluded to, like the mention of Islamic fundamentalists being blamed for an attack on Congress or for other political ends. A very lively argument today about how much democracies should adjust and change themselves for the terror threat. But this is written in what she couldn't know, but it's the dying phase of the Cold War. I mean, does she sort of miss the point?
I don't know, because I think she was so ahead of her time. She actually wrote this in Berlin and said that it was partly prompted by the Berlin Wall and what was going on both sides of the wall, specifically, of course, you know, in East Berlin. So she also, as the book moves on, it's an alternative future, isn't it? It's not the future, it's an alternative future. If we take one path, that's where we might go. That's how Margaret Atwood plays with this idea. It's set in the late 20th century. So I think she, to me, it wasn't really about the Cold War. It was really about safeguarding democracy and how democracy has to be safeguarded, how one has to be eternally vigilant about the things that seem so tiny, things like bank accounts. I mean, actually, that's quite big to me, but, you know, in the scale of what happens in this book, the bank accounts are quite small. And it's also extraordinary how Luke, the protagonist's husband, at first, he doesn't have a problem with it, you see, because her bank account is taken away and put in his name, and he becomes her protector, and he is elevated, and that's what's so seductive about the use of power.
Which is often a claim made by new governments removing rights from a section of society, isn't it? That it is there for the protection of women or the protection of children or the protection of a particular tribe or group. Kate, you've seen rather a lot of this.
She has, you know, in her narrator, a woman who is quite ambivalent about how she relates to the man whom she loves. And then this complete change comes over society. And she, instead of being able to fight it, she is horrified within herself to find she can't find a means of fighting this. It is so all-embracing. And I am reminded time and again, I think, of women whom you do meet in some cultures who we in the West say, why don't you protest? Why don't you get together? Why don't you organize? Why don't you, and you know, you have your little list of things, which we had in the 70s when we were talking about liberation. And this is going to be the action. And they say, you can't. The law says you can't. They have the power. We can't go out. We have no way of meeting. We may not do. And I've heard this myself from women today in certain societies and cultures. And Margaret Atwood brings this out with such clarity. And it's got, to me, huge flashing neon warning signs all over it.
Well, that's very interesting. See, I read it back in the day, probably not long after it came out, and I really warmed to it and I enjoyed the book, but rereading it now, and it'd be very interesting to hear any thoughts on this, I did think this is a slightly hysterical book, frankly, and also that she does miss the point. She can't just say, well, I'm sitting in Berlin and it's also about East Germany. Really, it is about a distrust of America. Really, it is about a trust of Christian fundamentalism. And what she seems kind of oblivious to is the fact that a lot of the countries have got many more of the things that she's describing in the book going on, or those which have rebelled against religion.
Oh, you see, I don't see it that way. I mean, Gilead is in America, but it could be anywhere. To me, what she's talking about is the slippery slope towards dictatorship. You know, you could use the same trajectory and put it on anywhere. So I think that was actually...
But she does suggest that you've got to believe that she thinks you're somewhere on it, otherwise it's not really a dystopia. If you think, well, this might happen, but it's very, very, very unlikely to ever happen, then you wouldn't take the book seriously. You have to have that distrust of America that she really has, and it seeps through every pore of the book.
I can think of two instances. First of all, when I was a student, I spent a lot of time listening to other students who managed to sneak out of the Soviet Union and came to Sweden where I was studying because they thought it was sort of neutral and okay and vaguely lefty. So they'd allow their students out, and I met Poles and Hungarians and Czechs and Russians. And they all said to me, as we all sat drinking late at night and saying, what's life really like where you live? And they'd say, you don't understand how to hang on to democracy. You don't seem to bother. You don't seem to care about it. You take it for granted. And I've never forgotten that. They said, we thought some of the smaller countries had a period of independence. They said, it is taken away from you if you don't fight for it. And the second instance was listening to women in Iran, in the Grand Mosque, where just after the Ayatollahs had taken over, and these educated, clever women who'd had jobs, been independent, said, you don't know how they can take it from you. And it's not just unfair, it's unjust, it's evil, they said. And look, the world is just watching us. And here we are in our cage. I've never forgotten. That is what comes through to me.
And there's a wonderful moment when Japanese tourists arrive in Gilead and look at the women, yes, and have exactly the same reaction to them as we might have if we were going to a country, yes, where women's rights were not as advanced as here.
I think that's a very good point to hear a little bit more from the book, which tells us about how the women in Gilead interact with each other. Melanie.
A shape, red with white wings around the face, a shape like mine. A nondescript woman in red carrying a basket comes along the brick sidewalk towards me. She reaches me and we peer at each other's faces, looking down the white tunnels of cloth that enclose us. She is the right one. Blessed be the fruit, she says to me, the accepted greeting among us. May the Lord open, I answer, the accepted response. We turn and walk together past the large houses towards the central part of town. We aren't allowed to go there except in twos. This is supposed to be for our protection, though the notion is absurd. We are well protected already. The truth is that she is my spy, as I am hers. If either of us slips through the net because of something that happens on one of our daily walks, the other will be accountable. The war is going well, I hear, she says. Praise be, I reply. We've been sent good weather. which I receive with joy. They've defeated more of the rebels since yesterday. Praise be, I say. I don't know how she knows. What were they? Baptists. They had a stronghold in the Blue Hills. They smoked them out. Praise be. Sometimes I wish she would just shut up and let me walk in peace. But I'm ravenous for news, any kind of news. Even if it's false news, it must mean something.
She is very good, isn't she, Aminata, at the interpersonal relationships which are built up in the book between the women and also between the woman and the man who is supposed to be trying to impregnate her in this sort of strange society which wants to be so moral and then ends up in sort of moral turpitude.
Everybody's fighting for their own little bit of turf, and it's quite interesting how people allow themselves to be divided in that way. What I found interesting about the book, we've talked about it in terms of feminism and women's rights, but actually everybody in Gilead is oppressed, you know, all but the most powerful men. The poorer men cannot get married, they have to work for the wealthier men. They are almost as oppressed as the women whom they are in turn oppressing. And everyone is fighting for their tiny piece of turf. And there's another wonderful moment where Serena Joy, who is the wife of the commander, she's the alpha woman, and there's a wonderful moment where he comes to her sitting room door, isn't there, and he's always supposed to knock before he comes in, and that's her tiny piece of turf. It's all she's got left, actually, is the power to say yes when he knocks on the door. But they're all constantly...
What did you make of the sort of polygamy side of it, which does give the book a frisson? I mean, I think if one's being honest, people quite like reading the books about the sex. But it is sort of odd in the sense that it is both reflecting on religious polygamy and Mormons and people who've had a history of it. But did it ring true to you? Because I know you've studied some countries with polygamous societies.
I mean, it was actually the least convincing part of the book, really, was the relationship between the first wife and the handmaid. And, you know, I mean, my family in Sierra Leone, my grandfather had 16 wives, so I had a little bit of experience of polygamy. And I spent a long time, I wrote a novel set in a polygamous household, and spent a lot of time talking to my aunts and my grandmothers about the way that the household had run. And the first wife, and all of the power in the household, really belonged to the first wife, whose power in the domestic sphere was far greater even than of her husband. She usually
did
chose...
you feel that here the handmaid ends up with too much power and it
yes,
really wouldn't
I did.
Happen?
Well, no, because the favourite wife, of course, is the next person who has a great deal of power. But I did feel that Serena Joy's kind of hopelessness wasn't quite convincing. I thought she would be more of a fighter.
Kate, no, I've known people in the Arab world where the first wife cannot have the child and then just gets elbowed out, but still is kept on as the wife, and the second one is married for childbearing possibilities. And the first wife has this kind of this position, but has lost that great lever, which is the important thing to the man, the ability to continue the line.
Do you know what it really reminded me of? And that was Bring Up the Bodies by Hilary Mantel, where as we study Anne Boleyn's descent, really from the point where she, at the beginning of the novel, she's incredibly powerful because she's still thought to be able to bear an heir and bring an heir up. And when it sort of, as it becomes clearer and clearer that there are problems on that score.
But it still happens today in those societies. And the whole thing is backed by, and I think you mustn't, I think it does matter, and matters particularly today, by the book is suffused with biblical phrases and the idea that there is the ultimate arbiter and it is what is written in the Old Testament. And there is no questioning of that. And in societies where that takes hold, it reaches a point where there is no protest because there is nothing to appeal to because what has been written down is perfect and that is how you live. And I find it, and I've seen it occasionally, it is very frightening. And I think she delivers the fear and the whole of society as you're quite right, not only does not everyone have any real power, but they're also afraid, all of them, for their own position.
It's all very downbeat, but without giving too much away for anyone who hasn't read it, there is then a prologue. No, the other way around. There is then an epilogue, which suggests that all of these things do come to an end. I mean, she's not quite as doom-mongery about women in society in the end, because she assumes that change is possible. And there's a little trick at the end which makes that clear.
You're not saying light, that it lightens it. It's a sense of relief that she wrote it to say, oh, well, actually, this was a phase that passed. Well, don't we all feel relieved that she herself has written it that way?
She says she has two endings, and and the second ending is contained in that epilogue. But I think that's actually what's so clever about it, is that if we think that progress, is the relentless march forward, actually, there is also regress.
Well, then we must leave it. Me, Anne McElvoy, my thanks to Aminata Fauna, Kate Adie, and Melanie Gray, and good night.
Anne McElvoy presented this evening's Proms Plus Literary event, and the producer was Laura Thomas. BBC Radio 3, it's time now for Norman Lebrecht with the Lebrecht Interview.
Lillian Hochhauser is a household name in millions of musical homes. The Hochhauser Sunday concerts that she ran with her husband Victor at the Royal Albert Hall introduced countless people to the live sound of a symphony orchestra. The menu was popular fare from the 1812 overture via the Grieg Concerto to Planets, Enigma, Beethoven's Ninth, but it gave many listeners the concert bug and many musicians a foothold on the career ladder. Lillian and Victor were also purveyors of high art. They brought the Vienna Philharmonic to London after the war and were the sole importers of Soviet talent after Stalin died. They enjoyed close friendships with Oistrakh, Rostropovich and other legends, and staged the first Shostakovich festivals outside the Soviet bloc. Their Russian ballet seasons continue to this day. In the opposite direction, they gave many British musicians and dancers their debut on Russian stages. Now that's the public face of the Hochhausers. The private story is even more remarkable. Raised in the ultra-Orthodox Jewish quarter of Stamford Hill, they were propelled into the music business by a rabbi who refused to take no for an answer. Their sense of mission was so strong that in their 80s there's no sign of slowing down. For the past 11 years, this summer excepted, they've kept the Royal Opera House alive in July and August. I meet Lillian Hochhauser in a BBC studio. Lillian, there were only two festivals that were suspended for the Olympic summer, Glastonbury and you.
Exactly.
Was that a logistical decision?
Well, it was forced on me. I mean, I wanted to be at the Royal Opera House, but they were not available because they were very much concerned with the Olympics and the Cultural Olympiad,
yeah.
And they have an exhibition. Anyway, there was no time and no room. So I had to take a sabbatical.
Do you remember the last Olympics? You must do.
Of course, I remember 1948.
Yes.
Strangely enough, I was in Switzerland at the time. I had a health problem, and I was lying on a Liegestuhl outside on a balcony in Davos.
On a magic mountain.
On a magic mountain, reading the Magic Mountain, of course, naturally. Mm-hmm. And just below my hotel, they staged the Winter Olympics. So I remember that very clearly indeed.
Tell me about working for Solomon Schonfeld, Rabbi Dr. Solomon Schonfeld.
After 1948, when I came back from Switzerland, I looked for a part-time position. And I had, of course, heard about him. Well, first of all, that he's very underrated because he was a great hero of the century.
Nobody saved more Jewish children from Europe before and after
thousands
the war.
Tens of thousands, that he brought out at
risk of his life.
Absolutely.
Flashing blue eyes.
Handsome, I have to say. Yes, indeed.
Ferociously articulate.
And intelligent. And would not let anything get in his way to fulfil his mission of bringing all the children he could from the 1938 till 1948, He even designed his own uniform. Nobody knew what it was, but it opened doors for him because he looked so impressive. He was so imposing.
He bought it at an Armley surplus store and he put on a badge that said Chief Rabbi's Emergency Squad.
Exactly. So I found it a very satisfying thing to work for such a person.
And then there was this young man who was hanging around in the office.
Yes, occasionally a young man came in who's he was already beginning to be known, in fact. Because
Victor.
This was in 1948. In 1945 came the start, the spur for his career. And that was as follows. Of course, Dr. Schoenfeld always needed money, a lot of money. He needed it. I mean, he had to get it.
Well, he
to
had
do
a house
his work.
And feed
exactly.
and clothe and educate
Absolutely.
The children.
And so he had the brilliant idea of having a charity, putting on a charity concert. It so happens that in the synagogue that he often prayed, there was a gentleman by the name of Kuttner, whose son was Solomon Kuttner. Now, best known as Solomon. He's the only musician or pianist who uses his first name as his name. The others use their second name, but he was the only one, and he's still famous as Solomon. And in 1945, they booked, of all places, the Whitehall Theatre, which was actually known in those days for various not so salubrious.
It was a stripper's place.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Right. So these ultra-Orthodox Jews are booking a stripper's joint for a charity
place.
Concert.
Yes, but perhaps they didn't know. Perhaps I should say. Whatever it is, it was available. The concert was sold out. And a huge success. And they actually made a lot of money. It was so successful that they immediately, in 1945, Victor soon saw that this was a very good idea. And he booked the Albert Hall for two concerts. And not only that, in fact, Solomon did not appear at either of those concerts. The first artist to appear was Ida Handel. She was, I think, 17. They also proved successful. And so that continued with artists such as Moiseevich, Kentner, Sighetti, bigger and bigger artists were coming along.
Myra Hess.
One more, Limpany. Adrian Bolt conducted many of the concerts. Basil Cameron and, of course, Malcolm Sargent.
Mm-hmm. And Yehudi Menuhin.
Then Yehudi came along in 1949. Mm-hmm. Another very momentous thing happened in 1949, and that was I met Victor. He used to come into Schoenfeld's office.
Yes.
Perch on the end of it. He didn't actually have his own office in those days. He used to perch at the end of my desk, and we got very friendly. I, of course, was already very interested in music, and I thought, well, this is very interesting. I knew Victor's name, and I thought, this sounds like a good idea. So I went full steam ahead, and I was 22, and I decided, well, it's time to get married, and we did.
You tell him it's time to get married.
Oh. Well, let's say that we both thought of the idea.
What were the qualities that you brought that Victor lacked?
Well, I wasn't bad looking in those days, for a start, you know.
So that helped with some negotiations.
Yes. My enthusiasm for music was undoubtedly a help, I would say. I quickly learned what it was all about. Victor had great courage and went forward, and in 1949, in fact, he had invited, as you said before, the Vienna Philharmonic with Furtwängler. It was a very great occasion, and of course, on looking back, it was a very big undertaking for two very young people to bring the Vienna Philharmonic to London. They came for 3 years after that, three consecutive years, during which time Yehudi played with them. They were conducted by Bruno Walter, Kathleen Ferrier sang, Joseph Cripps, Clemens Krauss. It was, in fact, a very overwhelming and wonderful experience to have.
Let me ask you, though, weren't there issues of conscience here? Victor had lost most of his family in the Holocaust.
Vienna Philharmonic was full of players who until quite recently had been enthusiastic Nazis, and two of the conductors, Furtwängler and Clemens Krauss, had shaken Hitler's hand. Was this not a problem for you?
Well, personally, I was, and both of us, perhaps we were slightly naive in this and carried away with the idea of music and great music. Furtwängler, we know. I know that Furtwängler was not a Nazi by any means, by any means. At the time, I actually didn't know. I should have known. I do know now that Clemens Krauss was not so clean. But, of course, there was Joseph Cripps and there was Bruno Walter. And I thought, if Bruno Walter comes with them, then it's kosher. We were, in fact, so intent on bringing the best of music. And when this was suggested to us by someone, in fact, Aimpen Williams then, we ourselves found it irresistible.
How did you get involved with the Russians? I mean, did you hear on the radio, on the wireless, that Stalin had died and think, hello, we might be able to get in here?
Not on the day that Stalin died, which, of course, was the day that Prokofiev died, as we now know.
Mm.
But we knew the name of Oistrakh. We knew these people existed. I didn't know Rostropovich, of course, and Richter wasn't known in the West, but Oistrakh was. And I'd heard a recording. And, well, as one is with Oistrakh, one finds him the best, I mean, amongst the greatest. And there was a cultural delegation here. They started quite soon after Stalin died, or just even about the same time. They sent a cultural delegation was here with, it was Bela Davidovich, Gilels, possibly, Gilels, and Oistrakh. But it was Igor.
The son.
It was Igor. And we thought, well, any Oistrakh, let's have Oistrakh. And we were organising our Sunday evening concerts. And we immediately changed the programme in order to accommodate Igor. He played Khachaturian concerto, and it was a huge success, of course, because the novelty of a Russian artist. The book had been closed for so many years, and of course we immediately sprung into action and said, well, if Igor is here, we must immediately invite David. And he did. He came, we did, and the following year he came.
How did you go about that? Did you have to go through the Soviet embassy, or was it...
Well, what we did, yes. I mean, we had to discover how to do this. We had a bit of help even from this delegation. They said you have to deal with the Ministry of Culture, and not only the Ministry of Culture, but the financial, commercial arm of that, which is Goskonsert, with whom we dealt for the next 25 years.
Yeah. Did you speak Russian at the time?
Victor was born in Slovakia, so he could understand Russian. I couldn't speak Russian,
right.
But I learnt afterwards, I, to a certain extent, that is. We found, actually, with the artists themselves, they all spoke German. My German was quite good. So we were able to converse in German. And Oistrakh came in 54. Then... they were very interested, of course, to send their artists abroad. Life was slightly easier, naturally, after Stalin died. And they used to, of course, send them very closely guarded. We used to call them Sputniks. We sent them with their guards, and they were very closely watched. And it was a very strange situation, because at the very beginning, they used to reverse the usual pattern of agent artists. They used to take 90% and give the artist 10%. So we had to augment that ourselves, which we did, of course. But to be able to invite someone like David Oistrakh was a dream, an absolute dream. He became our closest friend.
Did that open doors for
you? Yes, yes.
People knew that you were close to David Oistrakh and that
and
other artists began to trust you.
The artists had more or less to do what they were told, more or less. In other words, it was Goskonsert you had to deal with, or Ministry of Culture. There were so many wonderful artists there. It was incredible, incredible. Richter, of course, was not allowed. We knew about Richter. We asked for Richter very early on, it wasn't until 1961 that they allowed him to come.
Mm-hmm.
He was forbidden to travel. We started to invite more and more. And not only that, but we began to look further and invite dance companies, ensembles. We started to nose around the Bolshoi and the Kirov. And in 1960, we bought a group of dancers from the Vodka. They were the very first time they came. In fact, to the Albert Hall, the first group of dancers came to the Albert Hall, and there were... I remember that was very... every time they came, everybody came, it was more and more exciting.
When did Slava Rostropovich come into the picture?
Rostropovich came to England in 1956, the first time.
Right, you brought him.
We brought him in 56, and the hall was pretty empty, I have to say. We put him on, but that was the only time it was ever empty. He immediately was recognised as the genius that he was. I mean, really, great, great artist. And he was then 26, I suppose. Yes, he was about 26. And he came 56 and began to come quite regularly afterwards. We started to invite... We brought all the orchestras, every major Russian orchestra we brought during the late 50s, 60s.
Was there any resistance to that, any hostility from the musicians, the unions, even the government that you were...
No. We actually signed in conjunction on the first cultural agreement between the two countries together because we were the only people dealing with Russian artists. We were the only people who had any knowledge of them at all. And then...
So what, it's an agreement between the United Kingdom, the Soviet Union and the Hochhausers?
That's right. Of course, we were subject to various diplomatic crises, such as when the Russians expelled 105 spies.
Spies, yes.
Yes, 105. So there was still some left, I think. At that time, we were supposed to have had... Oistrakh was supposed to come here. They cancelled. The Russians, in retaliation, they cancelled. They said, David Oistrakh is very, very upset about the action of the British government, and he will not appear in London. We managed to find David, wherever he was at the time. Of course, he knew nothing about it. He didn't know anything about anything. Before this happened, there was a famous... 1968, when the Russians marched into Prague, and we were due, I think, to bring the Red Army Choir.
To the Albert Hall.
Yes, and they were all plastered outside, big poster, and somebody had torn it off and said, now appearing in Prague. In fact, then the British refused to issue
any visas.
Rostropovich was playing in the proms. The Moscow Philharmonic were here, and that all continued. That went ahead, and as you know, that was a very emotional moment when, of all things, Rostropovich did perform the Dvořák Cello Concerto, and no one knew whether there was going to be any demonstration, trouble, and so on. Two people did get up and walked out in the middle, shouting, "Viva Casals!" I haven't quite worked that one out, but anyway, that's the only thing that happened. So sometimes we were obviously affected by the political situation.
Tell me about Sviatoslav Richter, because Victor had the close relationships with David Oistrakh and with Rostropovich. They were.
Yes.
But Richter was really yours.
He was my boy.
Yes. and he is such an enigma and such an individual and so, in many respects, so uncontrollable. What was the nature of your relationship with him?
Well, we simply were able to talk together for hours.
About?
Generally, films. He loved going to the cinema. He was a wonderful painter and generally a most extraordinary person. He wouldn't speak on the telephone. If I wanted to ask him what he wanted to play, I'd have to travel to Vienna or something to find out, you know. And he, of course, loved to play in small places. I remember once having to sail over to Isola Bella, this little in Lake Maggiore, to go and find him there because he was living there while he was playing somewhere else.
But he cancelled a lot.
Oh, I suffered. He suffered terribly.
He had a tendency to disappear. You'd have to go scouring the streets for him at night.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, he did. He cancelled as many times as he played. Once he cancelled 3 hours before the concert was due at the Festival Hall. Nina, his wife, she phoned up and 3 hours before the concert, a telephone call, and this quavering voice the other end, Lillian, and I knew that tone, you know, that's a cancellation tone. And so it was. She said, "This Slava ist krank. He can't play. He's very ill. He's lying in a dark room and he can't." What could I do except to produce a huge poster, run to the festival hall, stand in the middle of all the people there and say, "Richter is ill." By that time I had managed to, it was a holiday actually, a bank holiday or something, and I had to find the manager on holiday, find out where and when we could do the concert again within the next few days. We found a slot 11 o'clock at night one evening, and I on this poster I put, "You can have your money back, the tickets will be refunded unless you want to come at 11 on such and such a date." And naturally, everybody came. And of course, another difficulty with working with Richter is he said, "How can I possibly know what I feel like playing next year? I can't know that. I can't give you a programme now. I shall know a week beforehand, you know." And mostly, I had to advertise the concert without a programme in it.
Now, as you say, all of these Soviet artists came with their minders, their Sputniks, their spies, their people who were designed to...
At the beginning, it got a bit easier later, I have to say.
But you started putting them up in your house.
The only time we did that was when Rostropovich decided to leave in 1974.
When he was effectively pushed out.
Pushed out, exactly. Yeah. I mean, he had a correspondence with Brezhnev, as you probably remember. Yeah. He came to London, and we went, four of us. There was Duncan Wilson, who was the ambassador in Moscow, and his wife Betty, and Victor and myself. We went to meet him at the airport. He was in a small private plane with his large dog, and he was totally and utterly lost. He walked down the stairs of the plane, and the dog came after him, and there was a huge cry, "Back with the dog," you know, because he just brought the dog.
To England.
And, of course, that was very tough. Mm.
Tell me about Dmitri Shostakovich. You brought him over.
Many times.
You put on this extraordinary Shostakovich Festival in Edinburgh. You managed to put on the Eighth Symphony pretty much over Soviet objections.
Yes. Now, that was very interesting, actually, because Mravinsky, who gave that performance, and he actually approached us to say, would we speak to Katerina Furtseva, who was the
Minister
of Culture. Whatever the case may be, it happened.
She had banned it.
It was the Politburo or whatever. The fourth was banned, as you know. Fourth symphony was banned. The eighth, naturally the 13th.
Well, the fourth had been banned since 1935.
That's right. And then these were all symphonies that hadn't been performed in Russia, or at least once. But we arranged all those performances in London.
What were your dealings like with Dmitri Shostakovich?